talk that matters. Germ Warfare and Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. A little change in schedule today, but I'll talk about that in a moment. One of the things that I have realized in the last 2.5 years is that a lot of what I read in the media should probably be taken with more of a pinch of salt than I had ever realized. There was a time when I suppose journalism was considered trustworthy. And before you throw tomatoes at me, I do think there was a time when people went in genuinely to try and find the truth and to report on it as best as possible. But with the advent of, I suppose, mega corporations, mega money, this is not an anti-capitalist rant. I'm not certainly not saying that at all. But I do think that there is a disease of the mind that has infiltrated much of the media machine. And I mean, I've worked in corporate media for 16, 17 years. I'm a political cartoonist, and I see how the cogs turn. And a lot of it now is about just making more money, more and more money. It's less about the truth, and it's more about pushing a particular narrative. You know, let's come back to the 2.5 years, for example, right? With this COVID narrative, this COVID story. I mean, the vaccine, which is not a vaccine at all, it's a gene therapy, and it's harmful. The data is completely clear. This is not even a debate anymore. And the irony is that you would have thought that, let's just pretend for a second that the pharmaceutical industry was trying to make money, right? Which they obviously are, by selling a product. But you would have assumed, and incorrectly so, that journalists in the corporate space would have wanted to report on what would be the truth, such as the harm, the side effects, and the huge spike in, I don't know, heart conditions over the last year or so. Let me give you an example. The Express. Now, yes, what's both funny and sad at the same time, right? It's obvious. It's blatantly obvious that there is a tight correlation between the increase in COVID shots and myocarditis and, of course, related heart issues. So you would expect there to be some kind of insinuation in the corporate media space. But this is not happening. Everything else is the cause. In the Express, right? Heart attack. Does skipping breakfast increase your risk? It's only beginning. The Mail Online, expert warns. And of course, when you see the word expert these days, you know, your jaw goes out of joint. Expert warns that, listen to this, shoveling snow can be a deadly way to discover underlying cardiovascular conditions, as straining the heart with physical activity could cause sudden death. There's the other one, sudden death. For no reason whatsoever in the last year and a bit, people have just started dying suddenly, you know, in their sleep, while walking. They're just dying suddenly. And the corporate media, the journalists, don't think to ask why. They're just reporting on it. And then they're making these weird correlations. Lonely older woman, this is now in the Irish Times, lonely older woman at greater risk of heart attack. And yes, where the trickery, where the illusion comes in. They're not wrong. Because loneliness certainly does increase health risks. But all of a sudden, when you combine all of these factors, together, you start seeing a bigger picture. In the New York Post, the little-known heart attack that's striking fit and healthy women as young as 22. Suddenly, fit and healthy women are dying suddenly. And again, in the Irish Times, physical activity may increase heart attack risk. Study suggests. Ooh, there's that word study. It's like saying expert. Drinking alcohol can suddenly trigger cardiac arrest. That's in the Express. Another one from the New York Post. Falling asleep with a TV on could bring early death, says study. In the Sun, urgent warning to gardeners as soil increases risk of killer heart disease. Yes, gardening is now a health risk, right? You're now suddenly going to die because of gardening. In the Daily Mail, living under a flight path of an aeroplane. I kid you not. Yeah, you know it is. You may be at risk of a heart attack. Study finds that rates are 70% higher if you're under a flight path of an aeroplane. Hotter nights in The Guardian. Hotter nights increase risk of death from heart disease. It is absolutely insane. So you would have thought that journalists were seeking the truth. But you know what? You would have thought wrong. It's so sad that that is what we are seeing. Anyway, join Misty Winston from Freedom Fest 2022 at the Mirage in Las Vegas from 13th of July to 16th of July. Freedom Fest is an annual festival where free minds meet to celebrate, quote, great books, great ideas, and great thinkers, unquote. In an open-minded environment, Freedom Fest is the largest liberty event in the world, and it is heard only here on TNT Radio. My name is Germ. You're on TNT Radio.
News more twisted than soap operas.
Ugh.
And with worse actors.
You can't be serious.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Roman Bystrianek, thank you again for joining me in the trenches. I know it's early for you.
Oh, it's not too early. It's 8:15 a.m. on the East Coast of the United States. Land of the free.
Oh.
Well, it's all good here.
slight schedule change. Thank you for joining me a little bit earlier, and I'm hoping that you can stay a little bit longer as well, because this is a really important subject.
Hey,
and
no problem.
I know it's a little bit tricky because it's easier with visuals. So you're going to have to use a lot of adjectives and adverbs.
Yeah. It's always easier to look at the charts and say, hey, that's really, really obvious, but I'll try to be descriptive.
Well, so you're a co-author of Dissolving Illusions, which I must admit is one of the best books in the world when it comes to vaccine history.
All right, thank you. To that end, if anybody wants to go to dissolvingillusions.com, click on photos and charts, you'll see all the charts in full color, so you can follow along or look at the charts another time. So they're all up there for everybody to use, as well as having all the references that were used to make those charts. So you can verify the data that it's actually correct, which I think is important. Otherwise, you're just, you know, somebody made up some charts. So what?
Well, I mean, the charts obviously work in conjunction with what it is you're talking about. Where do we start? okay, let's talk about your history.
My history, well, we'll keep it short. Just a regular old guy, engineer, have an engineering background. So I like to think I think somewhat logically. So I have a background in physics and calculus and all that kind of stuff. And I focused on computers. So I used to write massive, huge computer programs to do lots of interesting things, mostly in the medical system. So I always had to be organized. I had to look at things objectively and think about things. By the time I hit a certain age, around my 30s, I wasn't feeling too well. My health wasn't so good. I was basically eating pizza and drinking beer and just kind of mainstream stuff. And I slowly, over time, learned about diet and nutrition, and I started reading medical articles. And I developed a sense that what I was being told wasn't reality, because there was so much in the medical literature that was in there. Everything from vitamin C to omega-3 stopping seizures. And I'm, I had to wonder to myself at the time, it's like, why don't I know any of this stuff? Why isn't it on the television? Why isn't it in newspapers? It just wasn't being reported. And as I got older, I had kids, and I was listening to radio programs, and they started talking about autism and neurological damage. And so as I was listening to these, it made me wonder, gee, why haven't I heard this either? But as I listened to the program, so I always had in the back of my mind that, well, vaccines might be causing some problems, and that could be an argument one way or the other. And this is over 20 years ago that I was thinking this. But at least vaccines stopped all these deaths from all these infectious diseases. So that was always in the background of my brain. And so I thought, gee, these deaths from neurological or damage from neurological problems is horrible. But on balance, probably worth it because it saved so many lives, right? But then I was reading through more books because I was always curious to learn more. And I found a book by Neil Miller. And in there was a chart showing a decline of deaths from measles from 1900 to 1963 of over 95% before there was that vaccine. So I was like, oh, wait a second, that doesn't fit what I was thinking at all. That doesn't make any sense. And honestly, I thought the chart was, you know, full of it, really. But I was curious, so I went to a local library and I checked it out using some books there, and they had deaths from measles every 10 years, and it more or less matched a chart. And I sat there like stunned. Why don't I know this? Why is this true? How could this possibly be true? Because you have the impression that these vaccines is what caused the decline in deaths. And it just, this chart was saying that wasn't true. So I was still more curious where they got that data from. So I ended up going to Yale Medical Library. I just kind of walked in and just said, hey, can I use your library? They're like, okay. I was like, well, I was surprised. I went in, I found United States Vital Statistics books, and I started paging through that, and I found deaths from infectious diseases from various timeframes. And so I started photocopying those. This is a little while ago. And I got all the data from all these different books. It wasn't all in just in one book. And I put it together in a spreadsheet, and I made my first chart on measles deaths. And it showed exactly what that other chart had said, just a little more detail. So from 1900 to 1963, I had an over 98% decline in mortality from measles before that vaccine in 1963, which just, I just thought was just insane. How could that possibly be? I then also then looked at whooping cough, and I found a similar thing. By the time they started vaccinating in the 1940s, you had over 90% decline in mortality before the vaccine. Mm. And that ended up being true for all these different types of infectious diseases from the early, in the United States, they started recording in the 1900s. So from 1900 to whenever they started vaccinating, mortality rate from all infectious diseases had dropped tremendously, including if you look at the flu, for example. The flu was a big killer. Flu and pneumonia were big killers back then, much bigger than measles or whooping cough. And the decline in deaths by the time they started vaccinating in the 70s had declined by 90%. And so that's a tremendous decline. Yeah. And then they started vaccinating in the 70s, and slowly vaccination rates went up. And for the next 40 years, they're vaccinating. It's very common to see that all over the place and various pharmacies around here get your free flu vaccine. And it's pretty much everybody gets flu vaccines. I know people who don't, but a lot of people do. And the mortality rate hasn't changed in 40 years. As a matter of fact, it went up and then went back down. So it's pretty much the same level as it was in the 1970s. So the idea that vaccines have, you know, stopped all these deaths is just not right. The data doesn't support it. It's more or less a medical myth.
Well, we'll get into that in a moment, in a bit more detail. But let's start then at Genesis. What is a vaccine, and what is it supposed to do?
Well, we can go back to the original Jenner stuff, how he came up with that. Or we can just say, talk in general, vaccine's really just a brand name. All vaccines are different. They're not. The original vaccine was made from cows, basically. It was thought that there was a cow virus that would stop smallpox. And the word for cow is vaca. So they came up with this term vaccination. And they've applied that same thing to all sorts of things that you scratch on your arm or you inject into you, or they just call it vaccine. Of course, none of them have anything to do with cows, and they're all very much different. None of the new stuff is anything remotely similar to what Jenner was doing. So, you know, vaccine, I think, is just a brand name. And with the current situation, when they're using new technologies, they call it a vaccine. They're not going to call it what it really is. And they're going to call it some DNA modifying therapy. Who would take it? Almost nobody would take it. But if you call it a vaccine, people know vaccines are basically magic. They saved us from all these diseases.
It's so marketing.
Yeah, it's a marketing tool. So you're going to call it a vaccine because people are readily going to accept it. They're not going to, if you describe to them what's in the actual vials and what you're getting, you would hesitate. You would say, no, I don't want to do that. But once you call it a vaccine, and then people name call if you don't do it, oh, you're an anti-vaxxer, then people just jump on the bandwagon. They decide, well, it must be safe. It's a vaccine. So it's a clever marketing scheme.
Let's start with the measles. What was the first one? The pox. Cowpox, was it?
Smallpox.
There we go. Sorry. Smallpox.
So smallpox is one of the infectious diseases that was around for hundreds of years, really. But starting, let's say, in the 1700s, people would get smallpox and die or be disfigured. So that was around. But they were dying from all sorts of other things like tuberculosis and the flu. Infant mortality was, you had a lot of kids, but because half of them died, essentially. So infant mortality was very high. People lived in horrible conditions. They were malnourished. It's not like life is today for most people. So people were susceptible to all sorts of different things going on at that time frame. Around 1721, a Lady Berkeley Montague came back and said, hey, we have an idea. This is what they do in the Orient, is we're going to scratch smallpox onto you. And so people started doing that procedure. And even though it had a 1% mortality rate, it caught on as a way to basically give you smallpox before you got smallpox. And the idea was to, you know, prep you for resistance to smallpox. So you would get the scratch and then you would go through a disease process. And the idea was once you went through the disease process, you were going to be immune to it. But unfortunately, again, a 1% mortality rate from a procedure is pretty high. And then when people looked at the statistics, there was more cases of smallpox after they started doing this procedure than before. So this particular procedure that they were calling variolation wasn't really a great idea, but it became an accepted medical practice around the world, or at least in the Western world. But there was always this idea, let's think of something better. And this man, Jenner, had heard rumors that milkmaids who milked cows were more or less immune to smallpox. That actually was not really true, but that was just this kind of mythology. So he decided to do some experiments with that. And so he would scratch things from somebody's hand. The historic case is Sarah Nelm's hand was infected with cowpox, and he took some from that and scratched it into a boy named James Phipps, and then later exposed him to smallpox, and he was supposedly immune. So that's how that all got going. That's, of course, not very scientific if you do a couple of cases where you scratch some material from a cow and then scratch it onto a person. That's not really scientific. There's no double-blind studies. But he was convinced he was true. So he started promoting the idea of lifelong immunity. You wouldn't even catch smallpox. That was his idea. You would just be immune. You're done. You don't have to worry about it forever, which, of course, was an absurd statement. but he promoted it to the various people in the area. He got some royalty involved, and they jumped on board, and he got local people to vaccinate other people with his idea. So he was promoting his idea, and it caught on locally, and it caught on with the royalty. And once it caught on with the royalty, it was pretty much pushed along that way. Mm-hmm. The lawmakers were all in once the royalty said, yeah, we want this to be done. And Jennifer got awarded some good amount of cash, and it all caught on. And so vaccination took off from really pretty much right away, 1799, 1800, they started vaccinating all over the place. So it just basically just caught on because it became popular, not because it was scientifically based or anything. Go ahead.
Now, I was just going to say, let's continue that. I just want to quickly go to the news headlines.
With a check of the day's headlines, I'm Darren Metzer. Sri Lanka's parliament has received a physical letter of resignation from the country's president after the signed document was flown from Singapore on Thursday night. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said he was disgusted after watching the CCTV footage of the bungled police response into May's school shooting in Uvalde. And Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi announced he was quitting on Thursday, only to have his resignation rejected by the country's president.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Roman, so you were just giving me some background into the sort of foundational aspects of the vaccination, I suppose, industry, because that's what it really became. It became an industry. And this is the weird thing about preventative medicine. It's unfalsifiable, and it appears to me that it doesn't follow any kind of scientific method. You were talking there that they weren't following science, and it seems that nothing has changed.
Well, yeah, back then it was, let's try it and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you don't have computers and all that, you can't really keep track of large studies and that kind of thing. So you look at things from your own personal experience, and then you go with it. And I think in Jenner's mind, he wanted to be famous. He wanted to do something really special. And he convinced himself what he was doing was correct. And so he saw a couple of examples, and he's like, oh yeah, well, this is going to be great. I discovered something that's phenomenal. And in some respects, that became true, because the medical establishment pretty much finishes at the story right there. They just say, well, he did this and we lived happily ever after. Smallpox went away and that was the end of the story. But that's not really what happened. Right out of the gate, there was a Dr. Drake who got vaccine material from Jenner. He vaccinated three children the way he was supposed to, according to Jenner's ideas. And then later exposed the kids to smallpox, which sounds like a barbaric experiment, but they were doing this anyway. They were exposing people to smallpox in a controlled setting. They would take smallpox material and scratch it onto arms. So this was a very common thing. So all three kids ended up with smallpox. So it didn't work right out of the gate. Supposedly Dr. Drake let Jenner know, but it didn't seem to dissuade Jenner from his notion that you were protective for life.
Was smallpox atypical? Was it atypical at that stage? I mean, had they never seen anything like it before?
Well, smallpox had been around supposedly for centuries, right? So, and certainly was around in the 1700s, but again, so were so many other so-called infectious diseases. Yes. So they were all around.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah. So he vaccinated this James Phipps, who, by the way, later died from pulmonary consumption or tuberculosis. He also vaccinated his own son with swinepox because he thought this was a good idea. So he took apparently pus from a cow, from a pig, and kept on vaccinating his son, who died from the same thing, from tuberculosis when he was 21. So apparently he was always a frail kid, and repeated inoculations probably didn't help him too much. So you had that failure early on. But you had all these people that had jumped on the bandwagon. So it just basically continued on. So there was a lot of doctors that joined in, despite reports repeatedly of people getting a vaccine and then later getting smallpox and sometimes dying from smallpox. So it just kept going, even though there were reports of deaths. And there were some doctors that, although that they had vaccinated for years, they later decided, hey, this is not working. And they would call attention to that it failed. But their voices never really caught on to the mainstream idea of vaccination. So the vaccination continued despite lots of reports of, you know, failures.
That's interesting. So were there not at that stage dissenting medical voices?
There were, and they wrote them in various medical journals, but the mainstream continued with this idea. People were starting to make money with this whole idea too. So, and then later on in the early to mid 1800s, Parliament got involved. So they started mandating these things because the idea is, well, we got to get everybody on board. We got to make sure we don't, you know, spread smallpox. So they continued to add more and more laws in place to make sure people were vaccinated. And the more the medical profession was in, the less likely people were to report problems with it. But there were still reports of problems and deaths with vaccination. So that continued on for, you know, decades.
What's next in the story? Like, what was the next chapter then? They just started looking for viruses then to vaccinate against.
Well, that's much later on. So in the smallpox story, again, there's reports throughout the literature of people even getting vaccine material from Jenner himself, or even people that were vaccinated by Jenner himself, and then they would get smallpox and either get very sick or die. But the whole thing about the, you know, so-called vaccination, it's a very confused story because Jenner himself thought it was from a disease on horses' legs called the grease, and that the grease was transferred from the milkmaids onto the teats of the cow, and that somehow changed it to a cowpox virus. Other people thought, well, gee, you can use goats. You can take goat pus or put goat pus onto a cow, or swine pox. You can put pus from a pig and put it onto a cow. And you can take that material and put it into basically a jar, and mix it all up with some water and make it into paste. And then you can scratch it onto a person. They also thought that if somebody died from smallpox and you took that material and put it onto a cow and let that form pus, then you could take that pus and that was somehow changed to the cowpox. And then you could scratch that to an arm. Or they could take blankets from somebody who died from smallpox and you would hang it on the heads of cows until they, you know, got sick or had some kind of infection. Then you would take that and scratch it onto a person. And then they would take that material from somebody's arm that they scratched from a pig, goat, a cow, a horse, or somebody who died from smallpox, and scratch it onto the arm. And then they would take that and scratch it onto the next person's arm. It was called arm-to-arm vaccination, which was around for about 100 years until they outlawed it in 1898. So it was a confused mess. Nobody really knew when you got a vaccine where you were getting it from. Were you getting it from a horse, a cow, a goat, somebody who died from smallpox? It was a big mess. And we know now that that would be ridiculous. You know, what are you scratching onto somebody's arm? You know, there's going to be bacteria and all sorts of different things in there, and the person would get sick, sometimes horribly sick, because vaccination wasn't just scratch it and, oh, gee, you're all fine. You went through a process of getting these big welts on your arm. A good vaccination, you would get scratched multiple times and you would have these big welts. Sometimes the welts would be okay and they would slowly dissipate over time, but sometimes they took over your entire arm. Sometimes they took over your body and killed you. So vaccination wasn't like this benign little, oh, I'll give you a little shot and you're done. It was quite the brutal process. As a matter of fact, in just regular cases, you would end up with on the fourth day, you would get a fever of 102 to 104 degrees. And you would have a sharp rise in your temperature again on the eighth day, with increased pulse and respiration. You would have headaches, nausea, diarrhea, swelling. And these were just the normal cases. So vaccination was quite a brutal process. And in fact, the vaccinators thought this was an indication that the vaccine was working because you got so sick. So, you know, vaccination was a brutal process. Sometimes you got really sick, sometimes you died. So it wasn't this magical thing that the industry eventually kind of came up with this idea that, gee, you just scratch it on your arm and then you're protected. And it was simply not the case. And so over the next decades, from basically 1800 to 1872, there were repeated epidemics and pandemics of smallpox, despite even 100% vaccination rates. So it wasn't working. 1872 was a huge, really, I don't know if it was a pandemic, but I call it a pandemic because it was taking place in England and the United States and a variety of other countries where there were huge outbreaks of smallpox. Why that was in 1872, it's not really clear, but there was a big outbreak of that. And so more and more people were seeing that this was not working. And people started protesting, but the state at that point decided, hey, you have to do it or we're going to fine you. So they would fine people who couldn't pay would go to jail for not vaccinating. The medical profession was now all in on vaccinating, even though there was debates whether it was actually effective or not. And people could see that people who got vaccinated were sometimes killed or injured, or it just didn't work. So people saw that. And so they began to protest against it. In 1885, the town of Leicester decided, hey, we've had enough of this. They protested. It was a big protest against it. And they elected a new town government that said, well, okay, you don't have to vaccinate. Their vaccination rates went from nearly 100%, which was very common across England. Everybody was vaccinated, to down 10%. And the medical professionals at the time said, hey, you're playing with fire. You're rejecting Jenner's great discovery. You're all going to die and you'll learn a terrible lesson. Well, that never happened, even though low vaccination rates, smallpox never reemerged. And that continued on into the mid 1900s. And basically, they never had a problem. And vaccination rate actually dropped across all of England into the early 1900s. And there was never really a resurgence of smallpox at all.
Roman, I'll be back with you after this break.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
The most powerful word in the English language is no. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi announced his resignation today following the withdrawal from the coalition government of the Populist Party in support of farmers who have been protesting imposition of Klaus Schwab's WEF Green New Deal environmental regulations, which have nothing to do with the environment and everything to do with government control. Like the Netherlands, Italy has seen supply chain disruptions, food shortages, and other social upheavals as farmers just say no. Likewise, Los Angeles is looking to reimpose mask mandates and vax mandates, both clear violations of the law, as even the New York courts ruled today. Government mandates are not constitutional and they are not legal. And it's time for all of us to just say no. After all, there's a lot more of us than there are of them. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
A man's home is his castle, but his men's shed, that's his kingdom. There are now more than 1,000 men's sheds across Australia, and they're more than just a shed. You can make things. grow things. Find a mate. Be a mate. Shoulder to shoulder. The Australian Men's Shed Association can help to find a shed near you. There's something for you
at the Men's Shed. Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
The Caesar Rodney Election Research Institute, CREI's, investigation of the US 2020 election found that Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg's spending increased Biden's vote by a total of about 200,000 votes in Texas alone. Though the difference wasn't enough to flip the state blue last year, grant money from the Center for Technology and Civic Life, CTCL, and the Center for Election Innovation and Research, CEIR, CTL, and CEIR may have pushed Biden over the top in other swing states. The preliminary results in Georgia and Wisconsin suggested a similar impact on Biden's vote margin from CTCL spending, and spending in those states was likely large enough and targeted enough to have shifted them into Biden's column. Joe Biden was certified the winner of the Georgia presidential election by just 11,000 votes, and of Wisconsin's election by around 20,000 votes.
This is today's News Talk and the Voice of Freedom, TNT Radio.
Roman, before we go further, if the vaccine for smallpox had no observable impact, what happened to smallpox?
I'll get to that in a second. I just wanted to point out there's throughout the literature, letters. For example, in 1882, there was a doctor who wrote a letter. They had to vaccinate a whole town because the town authorities decided that was a good idea. And the people suffered quite a bit. They went through the same fevers. Their arms were emitting blood and pus. They had to stay in bed for 5 to 10 days. Lots of pain in their arms, so they had to use morphia. To control the pain. And in the end, most people said they'd rather have smallpox than be vaccinated. So vaccination, again, was not a very wonderful procedure. And when we look at data for example, Boston, the 20 years before they had strict vaccination laws, there was less, there were less deaths than after. About 80% more deaths at 20 years after the vaccination laws were put in place. So that there was a lot of failures in vaccination for sure. What happened? So smallpox was historically a very deadly disease. So were many of the other diseases that were very deadly. It killed 1 in 5 people, essentially, 20% fatality rate. By the late 1800s, things began to change, and smallpox started killing less and less. The case fatality rate dropped. By the early 1900s, smallpox was then often confused with chickenpox. Very low fatality rate. Basically, smallpox just became not really a big killer anymore. It just kind of faded away. It just wasn't killing people anymore. That was true across the Western world and even in Africa. It just was not killing people anymore. The thing is, all of these so-called infectious diseases were all falling at the same time. Measles, whooping cough, scarlet fever, tuberculosis, influenza, all these things were going down at the same time. It wasn't just like smallpox had changed. Everything had become less fatal. So from the mid to more like late 1800s, by the time you hit the mid 1900s, infectious diseases were considered that they were a thing of the past. It was even written about in vital statistics reports that we really don't have to worry about it. They're not a big component of mortality statistics anymore, so we really don't have to worry about them. So, you know, again, all these things went, you know, basically collapsed at the same time. So
before you continue, your use of the term infectious is also quote unquote.
Right. So because all these diseases, except for smallpox, there was no vaccine for them early on, but the mortality rate had collapsed essentially by the mid 1900s. So things like measles had declined by, well, if we look at, so England had statistics starting in 1838. The United States started in 1900. So they were way ahead of the game trying to keep track of mortality statistics at a national level. So from those statistics, we can see measles mortality rate went down almost 100% before they started vaccinating in England in 1968. Same thing with whooping cough. Whooping cough deaths fell almost 100% before they started vaccinating in the 1950s, 1957, I think. So all these things went down tremendously before there was any vaccines for them. So it has to be something other than the vaccine that made the difference. And when we look at life, how much it's been transformed from the 1800s, where a lot of people were starving, there was no refrigeration. That came later, ice boxes and refrigeration. So people were eating diseased food, they were eating rotten food, they were overworked, there was no labor laws, child labor laws didn't exist. So there were kids as young as 5 years old or 4 years old working in mines. So then the pollution levels were off the chart. They started using coal. So smoke was everywhere all the time in the cities. So people were basically drinking out of toilets mixed with industrial waste and living in a chimney, working.
What could go wrong?
So they were not doing well for the most part. So there are a lot of very sick people. People were barely alive. A lot of them, you were just subjected to horrible conditions. Now there were people that did well, but the vast majority of the populations were not doing that well. So, you know, people were exposed to these horrifying conditions because there was no way to treat waste. You know, waste would go into the Thames and then people would have to drink water from somewhere. So all that industrial waste and human waste would go in there. They even had casks of giant wood casks. They would bring in the river water and let it settle. And so that all the, you know, garbage would flow to the bottom so they could drink, you know, so-called cleaner water. So it was a horrible situation. But then really starting mid-1800s, they started putting in the ideas of cleanliness, sanitation started coming in, clean piped water started coming in. And then as we went along, fresher food, vegetables, fruits, not diseased meat as a staple. So they were, you know, all those things came at the same time. People weren't subject to arsenic anymore. Arsenic was in the environment and people were mistakenly being poisoned with arsenic all the time too. So there's a lot of things going on that changed. So by the time you got to the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, all these things were replaced by refrigeration. People were eating better. They were happier. Labor laws were put in place. Kids went to school. They had to work before. So public education was just wonderful back then. And kids wanted to go to school. It was better than working in factories. It wasn't just mines. They worked in cotton mills and all sorts of other things where they were exposed to all sorts of toxins. So you imagine a kid in the 1800s, he's working 12 hours a day, even night shifts, being exposed to toxic chemicals, eating horrible food. What could possibly go wrong? Drinking out of a toilet, being exposed to smoke. It's amazing anybody survived, really. So, you know, had, you know, high mortality rate.
What's interesting, sorry, I interrupted you and we'll go back to your point. But what's interesting to that point is that you see exactly that still today. If you look at poorer areas, you will see a higher disease ratios than you would in, say, cleaner middle to upper class areas because of the, you know, the litter and the sewage and all that kind of thing. And you can see this anyway. The correlation exists in every scenario.
Sure. I mean, if you're not healthy, you're going to be having problems. Just the way it is, right? But back to what I was saying on that is that as you saw the deaths decline before vaccines, there had to be other reasons. And these are the reasons. And so you have a 90, 99, 100% decline in mortality. It couldn't have been the vaccine. And so this whole idea that it's just a germ that's floating around in the air that you catch and somehow that's the main reason you die, it doesn't matter if you're healthy or not, is just plain absurd. It's not true. It's not supported by any data. So it had to be that the improved health of the people and society is what was key. So it just basically trashes germ theory. Germ theory is, again, there's a germ, you get it, it multiplies and it kills you, just like that. And it doesn't matter if you're healthy or not, that's the way it works. And that's just a false theory. So that's why
at the same time period, Antoine Béchamp was busy doing his research in France alongside mm-hmm. Louis Pasteur, who was claiming that germs were just spontaneously originating out of the air, while Béchamp was saying, no, actually, it's coming from inside the cell. But that mindset is critical to the discussion about vaccines.
Sure. So, you know, if all that matters is a microbe, and let's say there is a microbe, and we can see bacteria, viruses are a different story. Let's just say there's a virus or a bacteria, and you catch it somehow through the air, and it multiplies and kills you. That's just not reality. The reality is it really depends on your health profile. It's that the historic data, they all show it. That's for smallpox, that's for tuberculosis, that's for measles, whooping cough, everything. Everything went down at the same time before they had any major medical interventions. Medical interventions have had a very little impact on all these things. Overall mortality, despite the medical system being so prevalent, really didn't have much of an impact on mortality rates. It just didn't. Of course, accidents and that type of thing. But as far as overall improvement in society, we have to thank plumbers and people who deliver fresh food, electricity. Electricity is the greatest invention ever. Without electricity, we have nothing. We have nothing.
Yes.
So all these things combined together is what did it. It had nothing really to do with the medical system. Unfortunately, they've basically laid claim to being the lifesavers. And we've failed to recognize that all these other innovations are really what made everything better. Not all these other, types of medical interventions.
I want to chat more about what happened after the 1900s, because you sort of taken us through the journey to around about 1870. But I want to maybe do that after the news. So just in the next two minutes or so, let's just finish off this pre-1900 story of the vaccine development and how it just got into the headspace of the zeitgeist.
Yeah, I think what happened is we had the invention of the microscope, and people assumed that it was the microbes because they looked under and they saw these little critters floating around like, oh, that must be the reason people are getting sick. And so that became an ideology, essentially, right? So it's just all about the microbe. As far as it was really all about smallpox for vaccination. There wasn't really anything else before the 1900s. The smallpox vaccine, as we talked about, Lester decided, hey, we're not doing that anymore. And so they just stopped doing it. Before that, they were being thrown in prison. And they just had enough. They said, you know, we know people who died from the vaccination, people aren't being in prison. So they stopped. And really there was no blowback from it. No one began dying in large droves. People were still dying of smallpox, yeah. But it was just a fraction. And as I was talking about, all these diseases essentially started fading away as a reason for dying. Life expectancy improved, but again, it's basically because we improved society. We got out of the toilets and the pollution and the poor food and the horrible labor conditions, and things just improved. That's the main reason life was transformed. I call it the greatest health revolution in human history that we forgot about.
Yeah. Roman, I am going to stop you there and take us to the news, and then we'll be back in a few minutes on TNT Radio.
Okay, great.